Fuck it. Fuck it. Fuck it. We deserve this win, man.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to your prognosis for regular season psychosis. It is the Purple and Black Pill. Hello, friends. My name is Ty Foster. I have been going mad. Mad. Like a lichen in the friggin' full moon at this time of year. Every year, this time of year, since about 1991, joining me, my best friend, a man who can claim the same, it's Duncan Smith. Hello, Duncan.
I was thinking lichen, like a combination of algae and moss. And I was like, how is this going to connect? But I guess a lichen is some sort of like wolf creature.
L-Y-C-A-N, wolfman. He's a wolfman.
I get that. I watched the second installment of the Twilight film series. I hadn't seen any of them. Or I guess I should say saga. And so now I know a lot about wolf culture.
So you've only seen the second one?
That's right. New Moon. I don't look back. I only look forward. New Moon.
I get that. I saw all of them on TV in Mexico like a couple months ago. After having not seen them in a long time, and boy, did I forget how openly anti-abortion the whole thing is. It's like written by this Mormon lady. It gets rolling really, really hard in the latter movies, and there are a lot of very, very crazy white lady fantasies start occurring on screen that are disturbing for those of us who are not that way. It's just really liberating for me to hear you of all people mention this, because I have been in the prison of understanding what Twilight is for a very long time, because my wife likes it for some reason, even though she's an adult. And it is psycho shit. It is kaleidoscopically strange world of lore.
It should probably only be liked by adults, even though it is about teenagers. It's like deeply, deeply sexual stuff happening, like hardly below the surface. Not below the surface really at all. Just so many intensely erotic moments in between these supposed 17-year-olds.
And like some of them are glowing, some of them can run so fast while Muse plays. That's the other thing, is like there's music supervision by like some hipster, so it's like Grizzly Bear will just all of a sudden start playing, and you'll be like, wow, what is this?
Yeah. Yeah, good times. I definitely need to catch 1 and 3 at some point.
This is why you're coming to the Purple and Black Pill, my friends. Of course, you want to hear us talk about Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson in a movie that's from like 15 years ago that was so bad then.
Yeah, or if you want to hear me talk about Saws 1 through 9 or Final Destinations 1 through 5, I can do that.
Alex, my wife has also been super into Saw lately. She knows someone who worked on the production of the new one, and yeah, they're really gross. I've not seen any of them, and I will walk in on my wife watching a Saw movie by herself and just be like, okay, I'm just gonna go do a critical analysis of Twilight by myself instead.
Yeah, it's pretty horrifying. I had never seen any of them until this year, and with the new one coming out, for some reason I was like, I guess I should know why there are 10 of these. And I do know why.
I can't do body horror. I'm a baby, man. If you show me like a picture of a person's skin getting poked with a needle, I'll like fucking faint.
Yeah,
so Saw's not for me. No. Yeah, no, I don't like that. I'd rather watch something psychologically horrifying, like Twilight Breaking Dawn Part 2, where like there's a little kid that looks like a racer head. Like, I'm into that.
Yeah, or like a Kings playoff series.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a professional. That's how a professional brings it back around to the point of the podcast. We're only 5 minutes in, and we have not yet even mentioned the Sacramento Kings. Hello, my friends. We're Kings fans. We're back from something of a layoff. This is going to be a little bit of a chaotic period because, as you may or may not know, as regular listeners of this program, I, Ty Foster, am moving up to Sacramento. I'm in the progress. I'm amidst bags and boxes full of belongings. I will be there next weekend. My wife and my dogs and I will all be in town next weekend. I will be catching the home opener versus the Warriors, which obviously I'm very excited about. And then we will be fully moved up in early November. So, you know, very much looking forward to getting plugged into the town. Very much looking forward to getting, finding and keeping musical appointments that pay me money around town. So if you know anything about that, please send me an email or something. But back to the matter at hand, Duncan, this is a basketball team that has expectations for being better than okay for the first time in about 20 years. What do you think they'll manage to do with that? And how are you feeling? Just what's kind of your top of mind vibe check after a 1-4 preseason run?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it would be fun to watch them kind of run the table in the preseason, but also this is what preseason's for, is to shake off the rust and try some things that you wouldn't try in a game that counts. And so I don't really mind the record very much. As far as my expectations for the season, you know, I think as much as we as Kings fans have high expectations, it seems like the league as a whole is not going to give us advance credit for what happened last year. You know, I think that the media and the betting types and all of that are kind of like, meh, this is maybe now we view this as a 500 team rather than a 10 games below 500 team. But they're not going to give us credit for third in the West and winners of the Pacific Division, which, you know, I'm fine with. I like another year of sort of being a team that's chasing quality status rather than one that's sort of presuming that they're coming in with the ability to win a bunch in the regular season. Having said that, I think we're pretty well set up for regular season success. I think that we have a lot of depth, which should allow us to, you know, make our way through injuries and slumps and all of the regular stuff that happens. And also, it seems like the team has enough goodwill from last season and just kind of a new environment that we should see players who are willing to, you know, like what's happening with Herter, you know, see if they can play off of the bench, or like if a matchup is bad, just go to the backup, you know, because that's why we have this depth. So I think that generally makes you pretty tough to beat in the regular season because it's not super top heavy. So yeah, my expectation is above 500, making the playoffs. And then, you know, what happens from there is hard to say. Like, even last season, we kind of got some separation at the very end of the season, but really for the entire season, it was like whether third place or eighth place was a matter of three games or something. So I think it's going to be very, very competitive in the Western Conference again. I don't know who's dropping out of the playoffs, but I do think that, you know, for instance, Oklahoma City is going to be trying to wedge their way in, you know, out of the play-in game and into the playoffs. I think there are a lot of teams that are actively trying to win and very few that are straight up tanking this season. So,
yeah. And by the same token, every single team, including the very best of them, has fatal flaws. You know, yeah. So it's just going to be a really, really interesting, fun, competitive year. The people say the West is stacked, and that's true. But it also is the case that every team has flaws as glaring as the Kings' defensive issues, which, you know, are pretty much carried over intact from last year. This is more or less the same type of team. You know, we have traded out a Terrence Davis and flown in a Sasha Vezenkov, but pretty much it's the same vision as last year, and for the most part, the same personnel.
Yeah, it's continuity with tweaks, and hopefully the improvement comes from the internal development of Keegan Murray and other young players, along with just the natural improvement that you get from knowing your teammates better and having a little bit more flow.
And just the psychological buy-in, you know, just it's about these guys, these young guys buying into their own potential.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, so it's a motivational issue as much as anything else. I have a lot of belief in the sort of the magical things, the vibe-based things with this group. It seems clear based on last year that the organization knows how to encourage that in a way that's really fun and organic and that the fans appreciate a lot and gets kind of just a collective feedback loop going that is very energizing for everyone. So that part I'm not concerned about. I am with you that obviously I don't care about the record. I think with a coach like Mike Brown, you care about a preseason record even less than you might with other types of coaches. He's so deep in his lab in this preseason from the minute it started. He was trying really weird stuff with lineups that you would imagine you will not be seeing when the games count. And also, you know, there's just sort of a cordial understanding, I think, with NBA coaches who are for real in the preseason that they're, you know, like what he was had a couple games in a row against Kerr and the Warriors, and they're running out garbage time lineups and playing them as though it's the playoffs, and that's great for everyone. You know, like that's fun to see, and it's really, really important imaginary high leverage minutes for these guys to really get reps. And you get to, you know, kind of see what you have in a guy like Colby Jones and a lot of people, just to kind of get us into a little bit more of the nitty gritty here. A lot of people, including me, looked at Colby Jones and was like, well, that guy's an NBA backup point guard for sure. This is the preseason, but like I had no idea quite how good he was.
Yeah, he to me, the biggest thing that jumped out was he looked poised, you know, like he looks very comfortable just playing his role rather than trying to force things because he's, you know, dying for minutes or on the flip side, disappearing into the scheme without making any impact because he doesn't want to make any mistakes. So I thought he did a really good job of striking the balance between being an active playmaker while also not playing himself out of position too much. Obviously, he's a rookie. He's a second-round rookie. He is going to make mistakes. But I love, for instance, like, he was going crazy playing the passing lanes, you know, like deflecting stuff,
yeah,
getting some steals, but also just like causing little interruptions. And a lot of times when players get heavily invested in that, they make the wrong decisions on, or like it starts to get read, you know, it's in the scouting report and people use it against them. And I didn't think that that was the case very much. Like he was making the right decisions on when to jump out and try to get a deflection or a steal. So that's the kind of thing that tells me he's just reading the court with a lot of basketball IQ rather than, you know, relying on athleticism or just chucking up shots because he knows he's supposed to not be afraid of shooting.
He's also just a floor general. He is not bowled over at all by the pace of the NBA game. He's taking the game at his pace with the ball in his hands on the offensive end, which is just an amazing, like you said, just looks like, reads like poise to me.
Yeah.
You know, reads like a guy who's just not afraid to be a point guard his way from the jump.
Yeah.
And that's astonishing level of kind of confidence, you know. And that's a similar type of thing that we saw in this team last year, is there was just kind of this preternatural confidence about them where they're like, it's like they didn't know any better than to be playing with anxiety or be playing, you know, with passivity. And this guy just really appears to fit kind of right into that mold, which is beyond the fact that he's an exciting player. It's an exciting thing that Monty and his staff identified that and found him in the second round when people were talking about him as a mid to late first rounder, potentially before the draft.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really know who he was. I didn't study the draft so deeply that I was like, had an opinion about Colby Jones, but I can see what they saw. He definitely has an NBA body, and he's not like a, oh my God, athlete, but he has, you know, the right kind of athleticism for somebody his size and his role. And yeah, I think the basketball IQ is going to pay dividends for him. If he can shoot at all, he's really going to have a chance of getting real minutes in the NBA.
Yep. So that's a definite bright spot that has stood out throughout this preseason to me. A dark side that you alluded to earlier has been Kevin Huerter's continued struggles. You know, we've been in this mode with him as Kings fans since about May or so. He really, really struggled in the playoffs. And he has really, really struggled in the preseason beyond, you know, just being in a down shooting slump, which is going to happen with shooters and is not something you really need to analyze too much. He just, to me, looks frustrated and out of sorts and like he's lacking confidence and like he's just, there's a tendency to kind of get down with him that worries me a little bit, honestly, because I do think back also to the 3-point shootout at the All-Star game, like weekend last year, and he just seems to kind of get a little in his head, and as a starting two that we just really, really need to be automatic shooting the ball, regardless of whether he's hitting it or not, just we need that threat of the 3-pointer kind of at all times in order to keep things in an ideal circumstance for the way that Fox and Sabonis play. I've been concerned about Herter, and I have been it's been opening me up to the possibility of life without Herter in a way that I would not have really been seriously imagining in the offseason. What's been your impression of Herter so far this preseason?
I don't think I'm all the way there. Obviously, it sucks that his slump happened when it happened. He was shooting the leather off of the ball for so long in the regular season that some regression to the mean seemed like it had to happen, and it's unfortunate that it did during the playoffs and at the end of the season. But I also don't really fault a guy for not shooting super well in the preseason. You know, like, it's, again, that's the time to knock the rust off. And I don't worry about the 3-point contest, or I don't think that I have seen enough Kevin Herter basketball to be like, oh, this guy has a regular thing where he gets snake bitten and all of a sudden can't do his job. So I'm going to need to see a long slump in the regular season to feel bad about it. Because realistically, like, the reason that it feels like he hasn't played well in so long is because the offseason happened.
Right, totally.
So, like, if you don't get a resolution to the slump during the regular season, the 3 months or whatever, 4 months of the offseason count toward your slump in our minds. But really, like, we have no idea if he was absolutely crushing it in the offseason. So, I don't know. I guess if we get 20 games into the regular season and he's still not giving a lot, then I'm going to be worried. But I will say, on the other hand, that I think the reason that it's particularly concerning with Herter is that if he's not spacing the floor, it's kind of like, what else is he doing, you know? Like, when Davion's not shooting well, we know what else he's doing. He's playing elite defense, you know? Like, if the shot's not falling for Sabonis, we know what he's doing. He's going inside and getting rebounds and setting screens and passing and doing all this other stuff. So I think Kevin needs to figure out a way to contribute to winning basketball if the shot's not falling. And, you know, I didn't watch a ton of Hawks basketball, but I do remember a time in the playoffs, I think when the Hawks notoriously went to the Eastern Conference Finals and knocked out the 76ers, that a lot of people were talking about Herter as, like, having a little bit more ball handling skill and ability to create than what had been previously known, because there were some games that Trey was out and they kind of needed him to be an on-ball creator. And so maybe it's time to give him some more reps, like, with the kind of drives that we saw from Harrison Barnes throughout the last few seasons, including last season, where it's just like, okay, you know, we don't have Fox on the floor or the clock's running down a little bit. Like, let's put the ball in the guy's hands and see if he can get to the free throw line and either dump something off or make a little mid-range or turn it into a layup.
Yeah, and this is where, you know, I don't mean to suggest that Herter is bad, obviously. But it's like you said, I mean, the fair criticism of Herter at this point is, what are you doing if you're not hitting shots? At your size, you should be doing something. You know, you need to be more valuable than just the guy who's kind of hanging his head. And, like, in that Atlanta run, to your earlier point, like, he was also demonstrating real potential on the defensive end. And there's no reason to think he can't do that. You know, that to me is what I mean when I say that his problem is mental. As much as anything, I think that physically he's got at least what you need to compete defensively.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And, you know, I'm not like mad. I just was interested for the first time when Mike Brown inserted Duarte into the starting lineup, which is, yeah, again, just an experiment you're going to maybe try in the preseason just to see what you have. Duarte looked very comfortable. It's one preseason game. Obviously, I'm not like basing what we should do this season on that sample, but it got me thinking. It opened things up a little bit, you know, for the possibility of a guy at two who were just kind of surviving in the starting lineup versus a guy at two in the backup unit who might be able to really do some serious damage. I don't know. You know, it also, there was a lot of speculation. A lot of people are on Kings Twitter are still very mad at the fact that the Kings retained Harrison Barnes. I think my position and your position are pretty well known on this, that $17 million is a bargain and a half for a guy that does what Barnes does. Barnes is not a perfect player, and he's not going to bring a lot of intensity necessarily, and he's not going to bring as much defense as you would realistically need to win a championship, you know, out of your starting three. But he can get us to the next phase. He can carry us over, basically. And a lot of people now are already eager to get that next phase going and are trying to agitate for, you know, the Herder, Barnes, Davion Mitchell, OG Anunoby package or whatever. Of course, Barnes not eligible to be traded until, I think, January anyway or something like that. But obviously, all of this is to say, there is a lot of overreactions out there. My imagination was stimulated by Brown's tinkering in this preseason. I had just not really evaluated the possibility of Herder as anything other than the starter. And I think if we are willing to sort of dislodge our understanding of what the starting lineup is, we may find some very interesting potential combinations with this group. There are so many ways to mix and match these, like, you know, 10, 11 guys who can play on this roster. So anyway, all of that was a long-winded way to say that even if the worst is happening with Herder right now, I don't think we necessarily have to be super freaked out. You know, I think that there's options regardless. We have enough talent on this team to survive it.
Yeah, we have the depth. We also have him under a long-term contract at a reasonable number. I think it's essentially exactly the same number as you gave for Barnes, like $17 million per season. And at this point, with the salary cap being as large as it is, that's a low-level starter salary. So, totally fine. I don't know that there's a trade available to us right now that is going to put us over the top. And I don't think with all of the kind of good vibes that we've talked about and the continuity and the value in citizenship among the players, yada yada, that it's very smart to do something splashy that's only a lateral move. You know, if there's a Hall of Famer available, then thanks a lot for your time, Harrison Barnes, Kevin Herder, and Davion Mitchell. But a guy like OG Anunoby, to me, I don't know. He's a very good player, but he doesn't, I don't think anybody would say De'Aaron Fox, Domantas Sabonis, and OG Anunoby is a championship core. Unless Keegan Murray is something really, really, really special. And that is possible. We want to see that happen, but I wouldn't throw the whole future into that kind of concept unless we have a reason to do it.
Very fair take. I think that that's a good place to transition into something I badly want to talk about on the sort of purple pill side of the discussion of this preseason. Keegan Murray gave us some glimpses into potential futures that look like we could be real actual championship contenders, because you put it, I thought, well, when we were texting about this, you very casually were like, after he had some ridiculous dribble drive, you know, off a Sabonis screen where he was just kind of handling the ball somewhat awkwardly, but just doing it. And he's so big and so skilled and so good at shooting that he just easily scored. And you were like, well, what if he's just Paul George? And I'm like, you know, other people have been saying, like, what if he's Kawhi Leonard? I don't really see that defensive potential there. But if this guy can be scoring at will off the dribble at his size, in addition to what he can do as a three-point shooter, the ceiling for this team, the potential for, you know, what we could build with these ancillary pieces if we have in Keegan Murray a like an actual sure all-star is a completely, completely different calculation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, he's so big and such a natural stroke. Like, I guess the first thing, like the base level of the foundation of his game, is that he's just an extremely talented shooter. And at this point, with what he did last season, I think the only way to look at his future is to say that he's going to be, if not the best, one of the top five shooters at or above his size in the league. You know, like, he's just going to continue to be a guy who can hit extremely efficiently from three-point territory. And we've seen him do that, you know, at the start of last season with his feet set, and then moving around a little bit more, you know, taking some things where he's not perfectly balanced, but he's big and strong, so he gets a clean look up, and he just has incredible touch. So that, to me, I'm taking as a given until I see a reason to not take it as a given. He was just so good last season. So that's baked into the pie, and then the next thing is, like you're talking about, having those little dribble drives and stuff that allow him to get a look up, and he's strong. He's not a blindingly fast or explosive leaper kind of athlete, but he's a fluid athlete. He moves well, and being able to put a guy on your hip and rise up above him and hit a shot in his face is one of the most important high-level skill sets in the NBA. You know, like, that's what makes guys into perennial all-stars, when they can get the ball and do that sort of thing without being wide open. So that's the next level for Keegan, and he's shown a lot of flashes already. Obviously, he's older for a sophomore player, so you would expect him to develop more quickly, but he needs to at least get the chance to play like a superstar for some games this season, because there's something underneath the surface with Keegan Murray.
Yeah, and it also makes things all the easier to rise up and score over somebody as a tall shooter when you display the ability to take them off the dribble and posterize them, as he did to Klay Thompson very early on in one of those Warriors games. And seeing him mix it up like that offensively, clearly this is a point of emphasis from Mike Brown, and Mike Brown has obviously found a way to speak to this guy through a kind of combination of good cop, bad cop techniques. And he seems very motivated, and he seems very focused, and he seems to have a very, very good understanding of who he is in the pecking order and how and why that's useful to everyone. Personality-wise, it seems like the three of them, Fox, Sabonis, and Keegan, could not possibly be more perfectly aligned. What they do seem to be maybe missing, which is, I don't know whether this is even necessary or not, but it seems that it has been present in a lot of these championship situations in the past, is like a psycho. You know, like they what they're missing is like a tear your throat out athletic defender. This is all fantasizing about things down the line, but what we have in hand in Keegan Murray is showing himself to be exceeding expectations at every single stage. And I don't want to allow my sort of projections on that basis to reel out too far. You know, he's not Paul George. Like, he maybe could be, which is just an unbelievably exciting possibility, but he's not that. So, like, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. But I do think it's reasonable to look at what he can do at his size. You know, as a number four overall pick, like, this is not some slouch. You know, like, it's reasonable to have high expectations for this player. He just had the best three-point shooting season for a rookie ever. You know, it's reasonable to look at that and be like, yeah, that could carry forward. And given that, he is the reason why I think the Kings will be better than they were last year. I think that they'll win over 50 games. And he is the reason why I think that. I think he's going to take an enormous leap. But, you know, again, I would not be devastated if the Kings were, as you said, hovering around 500 and kind of creeping into the playoffs. I think that that would be a lateral move somewhat, but it would not be a bad thing. We have to remember that these ascensions in the NBA, they take time. This stuff never happens on a perfect linear curve either. You know, there's setbacks and whatever. So if we're not getting something that's bigger, better, and more spectacular than last season, we're going to have to be reasonably well-adjusted to that, if that's what happens. Also, we're going to have to be reasonably well-adjusted to the possibility of injuries and other teams making consolidating moves that put them in a better position to compete for a championship sooner or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I repeat this concept a lot, but I do think you have to remember that this is not an exaggerated number or this is a literal number. 90% of NBA championships that have been won in the last 40 years have been won by a team that has an MVP on it. And we don't have that. We have two All-Stars. I think right now Fox and Sabonis are sort of fringe All-Stars. You know, they're not perennial All-Stars. They're guys who have made All-Star teams and also missed All-Star teams. So that's a really good foundation. But we don't have a player on this team who can reasonably be expected to outplay Nikola Jokic or Giannis Antetokounmpo or Joel Embiid or any number of other guys this season. So without that, I think the way to look at success this season is like build continuity again, build camaraderie again, be consistently good, beat good teams on a regular basis, if not every night, you know, just like be a team that everybody looks at and says, that's going to be a tough win, and go in and get playoff experience. And if we can do all of those things, then we're young enough and we have enough of those ancillary pieces, whatever you want to call them, to potentially consolidate if something, or to, you know, get really lucky and find a Hall of Fame type of player later in the draft. So that's what we should be looking toward doing, is kind of being like the Kyle Lowry, DeMar DeRozan Raptors, who are pretty consistently good, even if they weren't viewed as a championship contender because they didn't have that guy until Kawhi Leonard showed up. You know, like they set the foundation to be a good team. They retained quality players. They made smart trades, and oops, they accidentally won a championship. That's the roadmap as far as I see it, unless Keegan Murray just blossoms into an MVP caliber player, which is not impossible, but it's not something that should be expected in spite of how good his rookie season was.
Reasoned and well-informed, if not sexy, analysis from Duncan. Classic. just a couple other notes I wanted to make up and down the roster. Some really, really fun signs here and there. Small signs, but fun signs throughout the preseason. Kind of a classic preseason thing. The boys have had time to work on their, peccadillos or whatever. And Davion and Domas both showed up, especially in early preseason games, knocking down some threes. And it definitely got you thinking, like, man, what does this team look like if Davion Mitchell is coming off the bench being as aggressive offensively as he is defensively, and making teams pay in that second unit for leaving him open? Also, what might that do for his ability to stay on the floor against, say, Steph Curry in, say, Game 7 of a playoff series? You know, how might that change things? If he's able to hit 38% from three, this is a completely different situation, I think.
Yes, that would be a huge, huge change in the future of the team if he was hitting 38% from three. And I don't know what that would mean, because it would also have an impact on the way that we use Malik Monk, who's like so good and also has been, in my eyes, doing more and more on ball creation and with a really good effect. So I don't know what it would mean if we had two guys who basically had a really good claim to being the second unit point guard. But maybe it would mean that Davion could play off ball and let Malik be the creator and then just drain a bunch of open threes, which would be great.
The mind reels, I guess, is the point. Stroke looks great so far. I'll take it. I'll take what I can get. I'll take anything I can get out of that position, considering how much I love Davion sort of personally, how much I'm rooting for him to become the maximal NBA player he can be, how annoyed I am that he is viewed as damaged goods because he's like 25 or whatever. You know, I just think that he's in a position to really do something super cool, and I think that he's a guy who benefits from being underestimated, and I think that there's been a lot of that's been happening with him over the years.
Yeah, I agree completely. He's got a very clear role in the NBA, and his ceiling is going to be decided by his offensive play, because his defensive play is such a given. His age, but also just where he was drafted, you know, like he was drafted in the top 10, and that comes with a unique set of expectations, I guess. if he was drafted in the second round, he would be viewed the way that, you know, like Gary Payton 2 is viewed, where it's like, oh my God, this guy is such an incredible addition just as kind of a utility player who does so much on defense and also is just, he's a smart player, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true for Davion too. He doesn't have a super high true shooting percentage at this point in his career, but he does make smart plays on offense, regardless of whether the ball goes through the net for him as much as we would like it to.
Did you have any major impressions of Sasha Vezenkov so far? To my eyes, he was treated more like a role player than I was maybe expecting by Mike Brown early on. And I think that in retrospect, that kind of makes sense. But I was expecting them to be running a little more offense for him. I was expecting to see him see more sets that were intended to get him open, considering all that we had heard about him as a shooter. But so far, it's pretty much just looking like a lot of back cuts and kind of trying to pick your spots from him, which seems fair enough, I guess.
Yeah, I would say that I'm not that surprised by the fact that he has been treated as a role player. You know, like he ultimately is a 28-year-old rookie who has zero NBA minutes outside of the preseason, so it's natural that he would need some time to work his way into the lineup. That's both in terms of, you know, ability, the speed of the NBA, and also, like, the playbook and understanding the way that the Kings want to play. The Kings can't afford to design their offense around him when they already had the number one best offense of all time last season. Like, there's no reason to rebuild it around a guy who hasn't proven anything. So I'm not that surprised. I thought his individual performance was sort of a mixed bag, you know? Like, I like his size. I like his incredibly quick release. I want to expect it to go in as much as I expect Keegan Murray's three-point shot to go in. And I wouldn't say that's the case yet, but obviously there's a long way for that to develop. So I'm intrigued by Sasha Vezenkov. I'm not going to base my expectations for the Kings season around him being a starting caliber player or even like a high-level bench player. I think he's just like Malik Monk was last season. Like, anything that you get from him that's above average is gravy, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, you know, I think I allowed myself, given my unreasonable love of Eastern Europeans in Sacramento Kings uniforms, to sort of imagine the best case scenario with Vezenkov occurring immediately, especially just because he has had so much success in his professional career in recent years. And I am now looking at things, I think, the way that I should have been all along, which is this guy is almost definitely an upgrade on Terrence Davis, and that's that for now. He's bigger, and he is a more consistently good shooter, and he is sort of making smarter cuts, and he's less likely, I think, to try and do too much with the ball. You know, given those things, great. That's because that's the spot he's taking in the rotation at this point.
Yeah, I would say I agree with that, and I would say more than better player, better fit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, we don't know how good of a player he is, but we do know that we needed forward depth more than we needed, like, another guard behind Fox and Herter and Monk and, you know, potentially Davion, who some people might not think is a better player than Terrence Davis. I do, but some people might not. But either way, Davion had a very clear role that didn't duplicate what the other guards did, and Terrence Davis really didn't. And Sasha does, in the sense that he's forward depth, which we needed more than guard depth. So makes a lot of sense to me, and ultimately the risk is not that high. I think he's got 2 years at like $8 or $10 million a piece, and then the third year is partially guaranteed. So that's a fair, like, prove it deal.
Thank you.
The other new guy who has made something of an impression in this preseason, JaVale McGee. Kind of a classic JaVale McGee experience, honestly. Just having been watching JaVale McGee from the outside for so many years, he gives you so many things that are just absolutely delightful and electric. And he's like pretty much a bonehead. You know, he does a lot of dumb things and not that helpful things, but all of it kind of redounds to, I think, a pretty clear understanding of why the Kings were so enthusiastic about bringing him in. I think that the vision is clear immediately, which is he and Malik Monk as a pick and roll partnership off the bench, considering all the DHO stuff we're running with the starters, is just a great way to throw yet another wrench at your opponent.
Yeah, I think he's finished more lobs this preseason than we saw all of the regular season last year.
Yeah.
Because that's not really Sabonis' game, and it's not really Fox's game, and Alex Len, as big as he is not fleet of foot enough to kind of wiggle into those spaces that end up being lob finishes. So I was super happy to see that. And almost even more than the lob finishes, which ultimately, like, you know, an alley-oop is fun, but if that's a dump-off and a layup or a dunk that's a little simpler play, that's the same 2 points. I loved all of the, like, little touches that JaVale McGee got on rebound deflections, you know? Like, there were so many plays that he kept alive, whether it ended up in our hands or the opponent's hands, just, like, by not giving up on a rebound just because he was boxed out. Like, somebody would be in front of him, and he would just use his incredible length and, you know, at 35, frankly, his athleticism is incredible, too.
Absolutely.
To just get a little poke on the ball and see what happens. And that's creating those extra possessions, I think, is going to be huge for the Kings from a guy who also, you know, again, 35 years old. He's not going to be an elite defender, but in spurts as a different look from Sabonis, who's burly and frustrating but isn't an above-the-rim threat, I think that that combination is going to be really nice for the Kings, who've frankly missed that for a long time with Holmes. And, you know, like, we've had a really, really low-quality version of that with Hassan Whiteside in the not-too-distant past. But to me, maybe it's fool's gold, maybe it's just preseason playing against lower quality opponents, whatever, but I haven't really studied JaVale McGee's game, and I was really enjoying his activity.
Great fit as a backup, great fit as a guy. I think we're going to find that he will be a mouthpiece a lot throughout the year. He's a guy who doesn't mind kind of standing in front of the media and just absorbing whatever he needs to absorb so that guys like Fox and Sabonis can maybe chill a little bit. I envision that being a very intelligent sort of media ops kind of scam they'll be running all year. Because he's just a very approachable guy. He's a very responsible and professional guy when it comes to that aspect of doing his job. He sort of really gets the level of professionalism that keeps a guy like him in the league even longer if he's able to kind of be this political actor, you know, this kind of diplomat.
Yeah.
And it's cool to see that play out. I think that that's a very, very sophisticated thing that the team sees in him beyond his sort of utility on the court. So I love to see that. I think that he's going to be a very significant figure beyond, you know, the 15 minutes a night he'll be getting on the court or whatever. Last thing on the court I wanted to talk about. We're running pretty long, so this will probably pretty much be it for today. But the most significant sort of storyline that emerged for me this preseason was kind of a clarification and a real deepening of my hatred for the Warriors. I think that, you know, the Magic kind of final element was adding Chris Paul, the most annoying person in the NBA, to this team, which, you know, was his nemesis for so long. And him just fitting so seamlessly in as just like this kind of annoying, holier-than-thou little shitheel And I just wanted to point out that De'Aaron Fox did another one of his classic. We noted this many times last year because I think he did it like three or four times. It's becoming like a trend with De'Aaron Fox, and it's clearly intentional on his part, where people like Chris Paul will do some ridiculous performative gesture to try and get a call, and De'Aaron Fox will just make fun of them about it by replicating it to them in real time. He did this again to Chris Paul, but what was different this time is that Chris Paul kind of tried to walk away from it. And people need to go back and find this clip. I don't know how, but De'Aaron Fox immediately chases him, gets right in his ear, and is like leaning over him, like with this incredibly menacing body language, and just yelling basically in his ear and just bullying him, making fun of him, like belittling him, emasculating him. Beyond the like stupid dance he's just done to ridicule him in front of, you know, everybody who's watching at home. And it took things to a new level for me, and it got me thinking, like, what is it about this rivalry that is so enjoyable to me, specifically with Fox and Chris Paul? And I think it's because Chris Paul is a very prideful guy, and he is a very vain guy, I think, and he's lost his edge speed-wise in the last couple of years, which is natural for a man of a certain age, of our age. And, you know, he sees a guy like Fox and he's just incredibly threatened by how unadorned Fox's brilliance is. You know, he doesn't have any fucking State Farm ads. You know, he's just better than him by a lot now. And he's willing to say so. And I think a guy like Chris Paul gets away with what he gets away with by having this sort of air of respectability. And when you stop respecting these institutions that don't have any credibility and don't have any legitimacy, they wither in front of you. And so I am looking forward this year to the entire Warriors operation, the entire fucking NIMBY industrial complex in the Bay Area, no offense to you, Duncan, like kind of finally being rattled out of its complacency and out of its belief that it is owed the best things in life because it has been so fucking lucky for the last 10-15 years, and is shaken into the reality that De'Aaron Fox is faster, better, funnier, cooler, and smarter than you. You know, like you're at some point going to get passed by. Steph Curry is still doing amazing things. Steph Curry just stepped on all our hearts in that preseason game. You know, all the respect in the world to the Warriors. They did their thing, but it's time for the air of sort of unapproachability to be put to bed. And I think that De'Aaron Fox and the Kings are here to do that this year. And that's kind of my meta-narrative. I want to kind of leave the show on that note this episode, that my meta-narrative to watch out for this year is the Sacramento Kings are replacing the Golden State Warriors in sort of the hearts and minds of America. And I think that that's going to be a lot of fun to track.
Yeah, that would be a beautiful thing to see. I agree with every point that you made. I think that we do need to win a playoff series against them for it to go over the edge, but they are setting themselves up for that to, if not for that to happen, for the fall to be a pretty hard one. Like the broadcast of the Kings Warriors game with the Warriors broadcasters, a lot of time was spent on their expectations for themselves this season, which is great. Like that's normal. Like you should have high expectations for yourself, but there was definitely a lot of like, you know, at a certain point, I think the phrase, the drive for five was coined, like five championships, and good for them if they can pull it off. But I would love to be the team that made the drive for five turn into 2025 goal, because that would be both a lot of fun for Kings fans, but also like, I think it would do a lot for this team's specific mentality to be able to be like, okay, we, you know, finally got over the hump with the playoff drought. We went to seven games. We stared down one of the best players of all time. We lost the first outing, but here we are coming right back. We're younger than them. We're hungrier than them. And, you know, maybe we can be better than them if we actually knock them out. And honestly, the same would apply to the Lakers and the Suns. And like, if the Kings are able to go into any playoff series against a Pacific Division team and win, it's going to change everything for us. So
I absolutely agreed, but all I'm saying is that Chris Paul's presence makes it a lot easier to see the Kings making it up for that, if you know what I mean. Specifically De'Aaron Fox. I think De'Aaron Fox hates Chris Paul. That's how it looks. And that, to me, just is yet another on the list of 650,000 things that I love about De'Aaron Fox and relate to about him. So, you know, keep your eyes peeled for that. We got to get going. We're pushing an hour here. But speaking as you did of the Warriors broadcast, I just wanted to take a moment to say I am sensitive to Golden State Warriors fans in a way that I haven't been before I saw that broadcast. Like, I too would be a total piece of shit if I had to listen to that every single game that I watch my team play. That was genuinely the worst sports broadcast I've ever seen in my life. There was a significant period in the first half where they had some executive VP, like some, you know, some guy who works in basketball ops who sounded exactly like Ben Shapiro. And he was on the broadcast for a whole quarter. And he was like, you know, I'm going to drive for five and quite some time. And I was just like, bro, this is an entertainment product. Like, this is unconscionable. Like, it was so boring. Also, like, that broadcast did not deign to mention the Sacramento Kings, but like two or three times in hours. It was just miserable.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of personal brand stuff going on with that team. I think now you're pretty far outside of basketball when I'm supposed to like have an opinion about the, you know, third person in the line of succession to the GM.
Right. Yeah, we're getting into, you know, we're getting into succession territory, and I'm like, I don't even watch that show. Stresses me out. I don't even watch that show.
I don't want that in my sports. I know what you mean.
No, I know. I get it. Also, just since we're talking about broadcasts, real quick before we go, shout out to Mark Jones, as always, just the homie. He was on the ESPN broadcast with Richard Jefferson, and just, you could tell it got worse and worse throughout the broadcast. He just hates Richard Jefferson's guts. Richard Jefferson is so annoying, and Mark Jones was not even beginning to hide his contempt for him by the end. Like, at one point, he's like, oh, yeah, would you go to Arizona? Yeah, well, I went to NYU. He's like, you're dumb. I hate you. Stop talking. It was so funny. There were a million examples like that. It was so catty. And Richard Jefferson is not up for it. Mark Jones is like fucking, you know, talks like he's like an American gangster or something. You know, he's like spitting 70s idioms.
Yeah, he's got razzle dazzle for sure.
It's amazing. He's like Clyde Frazier or something like that, you know?
Except that he almost always makes sense.
Right, that's true. Anyway, look, I'm rambling. That's it. There's plenty more, obviously, to talk about. And we have a little bit of time before the season starts. We have a few days, but I'm moving. Duncan's working. We're going to record again next weekend, and we will talk to you as soon as we can. We're so excited. I'll be in Sac soon. See you, my friends. Bye-bye.
Later.